I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Major support for Classical Music Connection is provided by Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. Let's find out what's on today's program. In the BBC Music Magazine for June of 2022, Rebecca Franks congratulates Russian-German pianist Igor Levit on winning Album of the Year. Igor Levit is no stranger to the BBC Music Magazine Awards. In 2014, he was named Newcomer of the Year for his debut recording of Beethoven's late piano sonatas, which our critic described as perfection. Several highly praised discs later, the Russian-German pianist has struck gold again, with an unmissable recording of Shostakovich and Ronald Stevenson, titled On DSCH. Not only has it scooped Levit the instrumental award in the public vote, but the jury has also given him the top gong, Recording of the Year. It is a huge personal honor to win, says Levit. Thank you so much. And it matters to Levit that the awards are for this album, as it features two composers close to his heart. The starting point is Shostakovich's 24 Preludes and Fugues, which the Soviet composer wrote in the early 1950s. Without doubt, this is Shostakovich's most important work for piano, says Levit, a kind of musical diary written in the grip of censorship. There is something unique about this combination of warmth and immediacy on the one side and pure loneliness on the other, he reflects. For me, it is a ritual of self-exploration and self-discovery that deals with very intimate questions. A very special aspect is that you have the 23 highly individual preludes and fugues, almost like encountering 23 different human beings, each with their own unique story to tell, continues Levit. Then, at the very end, once you arrive at number 24, this is the piece that creates the idea of togetherness, of communion. As a result, it has always made sense to Levit to play the cycle, all 2.5 hours of it in its entirety. If the stylistic language of the Preludes and Fugues is pure Shostakovich, its musical model dates from centuries earlier. In this work, the composer pays homage to Bach, offering a modern counterpoint to the well-tempered clavier, and there are other connections between the two composers. Both wrote their own monograms into their music, spelling out B-A-C-H and D-S-C-H in notes. Shostakovich's motif became the basis for the second work on Levit's album, Stevenson's Passacaglia on D-S-C-H of 1962. Often considered the longest single-movement piano piece in the repertoire. Sadly, I never met Stevenson, but I gather he was a larger-than-life figure, a very gentle person, highly educated, nonconformist, and, of course, a Marxist, says Levit. His Passacaglia on DSCH is dedicated to Shostakovich, who himself was a master of the Passacaglia form. So, we come full circle. Levit has been playing the Scottish composer's Passacaglia in concert in recent years, including at London's Wigmore Hall, where his performances have been met with rave reviews. It is the most international piece I know, says Levit. the musical embodiment of the idea that there is no such thing as a nation state. This piece therefore travels with you from one country to another and is pure internationalism. It is a most astonishing piece, second to none. It is also, by any standard, astonishingly difficult to master. It is brutally polyphonic, with 25 things happening at the same time, yet you only have 10 fingers, he says. Yet none of that matters in the end, as the experience of playing or hearing it is all that matters. It is a compendium of life, music that tells us of our responsibility towards the world as a whole, as referenced and heard in its diversity and inclusivity. That's very much in keeping with Levitt's life and career to date. He is engaged with politics and the myriad issues facing society today, sharing his views everywhere from Twitter to mainstream TV in Germany. His artistry and activism are intertwined. When he embarks on a new musical project, he gives it his all. I am drawn to works that speak to my soul, and in which the great questions of human existence may be found, he says. Whether it be Ferruccio Busoni, Thelonious Monk, Frederick Zerzewski, or Bill Evans, once I feel a connection, then I am fully engaged, and all I want to do is play. He's also involved in every aspect of his albums, including the covers. On DSCH features vivid original artwork by Christoph Niemann, a German illustrator and author. His cover is colorful, kaleidoscopic even, playful, curious, light, and sensual, and I am deeply grateful that he was able to be part of the project, says Levitt. On DSCH was released in the second year of the pandemic, a time which saw Levitt rise to the challenge posed by concert hall closures. During that first global wave of COVID, he streamed online more than 50 live daily performances from his home, including the Shostakovich and the Stevenson. Now he's embracing the real world again. I am delighted to have just been appointed co-artistic director of the International Spring Festival in Heidelberg, which is wonderful, he says. I'm learning new repertoire, and I am very much enjoying being back on the road after all the months of lockdown, and making exciting new plans for the future. In the March 2019 edition of Fanfare Cincinnati, Peter Lackey has an article about French composer Edgard Varèse. We all wonder sometimes what it would be like if we could, or if we had to, start our lives all over. Yet few people, at least few composers, have ever done so more completely and more uncompromisingly than Edgard Varèse. Born in France and raised in part in Italy, Varèse studied at the Schola Cantorum in Paris and later at the Conservatoire. As a young man, he mingled with such luminaries as Picasso, Max Jacob, and Fernand Léger. Among composers, Claude Debussy and Erik Satie noticed his talents and became his friends. In 1908, Varèse went to Berlin, where he spent the better part of the next 7 years receiving encouragement from Richard Strauss and Ferruccio Busoni. His orchestral work, Bourgogne, was performed in Berlin thanks to the personal support of Strauss. Varèse later destroyed the score of Bourgogne. The rest of his works perished in a warehouse fire in Berlin. So when Verrez arrived in New York in December 1915, he quite literally had to start over both personally and professionally. According to biographer Fernand Dwalet, quote, he had $90 in his pocket and knew only two words of English, unquote. The personal and professional aspects, of course, were merely reflections of one another. Varese's move to the United States during World War I was but the outward manifestation of the important intellectual development that had begun during the last European years. In general, Varese felt that Western music was too restricted by constraints imposed by traditional patterns of form and metric rhythm, as well as the tempered system of 12 chromatic notes. As he put it in a lecture given during the last years of his life, quote, my aim has always been the liberation of sound, to throw open the whole world of sound to music, unquote. His innovations, far more radical than those of Schoenberg, Stravinsky, Ives, or Bartok, were aimed at discovering sounds that had not been used in a musical works before. He heard these sounds clearly in his head and strove to realize them with the technical means at his disposal. Many of Varese's ideas could only materialize after the advent of electronic music. He was in his 70s when he was finally able to write a poème électronique for Le Corbusier's Philips Pavilion at the World's Fair in Brussels. In the BBC Music Magazine for August of 2022, Clive Paget discusses Mahler with conductor Semyon Bychkov. Leningrad, 1964. Darkness. A young boy waits with bated breath. Bit by bit, he's enveloped in a swelling cocoon of D major. His hiding place is a secret, located behind the stage at Capella Hall, an 18th-century auditorium with excellent acoustics. The lad, he's 12, is bunking class. His name is Semyon Mayevich Bychkov. And by rights, he should be next door at the Glinka Choir School. It's not the first time he's snuck off to hear Leningrad Philharmonic rehearse. But this time, he couldn't have torn himself away if he'd wanted to. He's hopelessly smitten. Walking the city a few hours later, the youngster sees a poster for a performance of Gustav Mahler's Third Symphony to be given that night. What he has just heard was the work's finale. The movement the composer called What Love Tells Me. The man and his music will become a constant for Bychkov over the next 58 years, culminating in his first recorded cycle of the nine symphonies for pentatone, beginning with number 4 earlier this year. This summer, he will also conduct Mahler at the Edinburgh International Festival. Sitting outside a London cafe in the here and now, Bychkov is relaxed. I ask him about that first encounter with Mahler. I went nuts, he exclaims, knocking back his regular double espresso. I forgot everything. I had no idea what it was. The name of the composer meant nothing because his music wasn't played so often. Et voila. From that moment, the whole world became a dream. Mahler famously declared that a symphony must be like the world. It must contain everything. Likewise, his music can provoke a world of reactions. For Bychkov, it was Mahler's status as creator and interpreter rolled into one, that allowed him to encapsulate the often contradictory worlds of humans and nature, creating his unique perspective, symphony by symphony. Every time Mahler takes that musical journey, he is growing, he says. The man was obsessed with existence. Each work, in a way, wants to show what the world is and what he wants it to be, which always brings conflict. And I'm pretty sure that dark side and the doubts were there from the very beginning. In a way, it's dangerous music because it affects you very deeply. Sometimes not in a healthy way, he chuckles, drawing pleasurably on a cigarette. Strauss, for me, is extremely healthy. It's fantastic on the skin, you know. Mahler is something else. Mahler struggled, not just as a composer, but as a human being. He was understood and accepted, Bychkov explains, but by a relatively small group of people. When they were first performed, the quiet movements of a lot of the symphonies would be greeted with approval, and the rest would be booed, he says. If it is not played in an outstanding way, it can sound like bad music. You know what I mean? We cannot judge his contemporaries if his music was presented in a way that failed to reveal its true, original, and extraordinary characteristics. A few weeks later, I follow Bychkov to Prague to talk further about his urge to do Mahler justice in performance, a compulsion that has led him down rocky roads at times. After his Damascene encounter with the Third, he explains how, as an adolescent conductor, he then became obsessed by the Fifth. By that time, he was at the Leningrad Conservatory studying with Ilya Musin. Winning the Rachmaninoff competition at the age of 19, an almost unheard-of achievement, Bychkov was invited to make his debut with the Leningrad Philharmonic. Musin knew I was obsessed with number 5, and he said, "Why don't you do that?" I lost my breath, and I said, "But Ilya Alexandrovich, I don't know what to do with the scherzo." So I didn't do it for that reason. Bychkov recounts the story of a letter the composer wrote around the time he was rehearsing the premiere of the Fifth Symphony, where he laments that he hadn't been born into an uncomplicated trade like a cobbler. Mahler said, 50 years from now, this music will still be massacred. Meaning that conductors would do it too fast, Bychkov concludes. But imagine at that time musicians playing this music without having any point of reference. Nothing, just pure notes. It must have been horrific. For practical experience as a Mahler conductor, Bychkov had to wait until he arrived in the U.S. In the summer of 1979, he finally conducted the Fifth Symphony with the Grand Rapids Symphony Orchestra. "I'm sure the scherzo was a mess, but I have no idea," he laughs. "At that point, you are so innocent. It's just you and the music, and the rest doesn't matter." Mahler II followed, also in Grand Rapids, and then with the Buffalo Philharmonic. Both symphonies would become international calling cards. With others, he was more hesitant at first. He performed number 6 in Buffalo and with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, though he found the half-hour finale an enormous challenge, structurally and in every way. He admits to similar problems with the relatively plain-speaking first. "The finale was a problem for me, to find a way with it," he confesses. "Also, the first movement, it's pastoral, but the evolution of the tempo is very complex. So I waited until my years in Paris in the 1990s. Number 3 also had to wait for Paris. That one I delayed a long time, but for number 9 I waited much longer. Much, much longer. I first proposed it in Grand Rapids. That was the first time I scheduled it and the first time I canceled. The first of 4. By the time I went to Cologne in 1997, I'd given up even scheduling it. It wasn't until he reached his early 50s that Bychkov finally bit the bullet. So, what was he afraid of? Everything, 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 he shakes his head. Just to come to grips with the texture. It is so deathly polyphonic. The lines flow independently while still being, of course, together. The tonal progression is enormous. In that sense, it is very Tristan-esque. I had a colossal emotional hesitance to conduct something like that. The burlesque is very tough technically, but that can be overcome. No, in this case, it is the emotional content of the music. What I did not realize at the time is that the end of the finale is not tragic. It's when the material side disappears and becomes pure spirit, which means liberation. But that I could not know until I had actually conducted it. As for the 8th, the so-called Symphony of 1,000, Bychkov considers the challenge is to be convinced by the first movement. One simply has to believe in it, but it's worth believing in. And the various completions of the 10th? I don't feel the need. It's not a judgment. It's just that I don't feel the need. Fond of metaphors, Bychkov compares figuring out each symphony to robbing a bank. Every safe will have a combination, although the bank is the same. He smiles. So what are you going to do? Are you going to blow it with dynamite? Or will you discover the combination that will open the door? Occasionally, he has had help breaking the code. He used to consider number 7 the least accessible of the symphonies, until he heard Bernhard Haitink conduct it on the Dutch conductor's final visit to Chicago. You can beat your head for years, and then suddenly the door opens, he explains. And Bernard opened the door for me in that symphony on that day. It was the same with Callahan and number 9. I heard him in 1983, his last visit with the Berliners at Carnegie Hall. Those are crucial experiences. For his latest attempts at Mahlerian safe-cracking, his partner in crime is the Czech Philharmonic. Bychkov was appointed chief conductor in 2018, but the orchestra has been on a Mahler journey of its own ever since the composer conducted the premiere of his 7th symphony in Prague back in 1908. In the 1970s and 80s, chief conductor Václav Neumann championed Mahler, recording a respected cycle for the Supraphon label. The connections, however, are even more intriguing. Whether you consider Mahler the property of Vienna or a globe-trotting cosmopolitan, there's no denying his roots. Born in the Bohemian village of Kalistie in 1860, the composer grew up in the Czech countryside, surrounded by Czech music. Mahler was born in this country. Their DNA is his DNA, says Bychkov. In this country, I feel every person is born a musician. The majority will do something else in life, but essentially, they are musical people. They also have a fantastic sense of humor. Black humor. Kafka. You know what I mean. They have this connection to something bizarre and ultimately terribly funny, even when it's tragic. The richness of the Czech Philharmonic sound, he believes, is partly shaped by its auditorium, with its elaborately decorated ceiling and loggias supported by gilded pillars. The Rudolfinum is a jewel box of a hall. But when Mahler is on the menu, the modest stage bursts at the seams with musicians. With no room to swing a cat, the orchestra moves as one. They could hardly do otherwise. It's a small hall, yet at no time do I feel it saturated, whereas in many, many contemporary halls, you go to a certain point and from there on it's like hitting a wall, Bychkov says, driving his fist into his hand. It can be very unpleasant. All of which begs the million-dollar question. Why does the world need another Mahler cycle? Why not? Bychkov replies with a twinkle in his eye. I counter, asking if there's something he wants to say that hasn't been said before. No, of course not. It's not about me. It's really not about me. Tell me, why would someone recreate Hamlet again and again? Because they must. Because they can't not do it. If you don't feel that inner compulsion to do it, you shouldn't. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, with generous support from Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me next week for Classical Music Connection.